I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. 50 years ago, this week in 1971, the New York Times published its first article on the Pentagon Papers, the government study commissioned by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara about the U.S. involvement in the widening Vietnam War from the administrations of Harry Truman through Lyndon Johnson. Daniel Ellsberg, who was an analyst with the RAND Corporation, leaked the documents to the Times and then the Washington Post because of his growing criticism of the war and the lies being told to the American people that the war was winnable, for one. The Nixon administration took the Times and the Post to court to stop publication, but the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on June 30th that the papers could continue to publish the material in a landmark case involving freedom of the press. Joining us by Skype is Elizabeth Becker, who was a correspondent covering Cambodia during the Vietnam War. This was back in the 1970s, and it was for the New York Times. She's the author of You Do Not Belong Here, about women journalists who covered the Vietnam War. She was a senior foreign editor for NPR back in the 1990s. Elizabeth Becker, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
What was your response when the first of a series of articles was published in the New York Times? Do you remember? This was 50 years ago.
Sure. I was just entering graduate school and had already been very immersed in all the criticisms of the war because I don't know if your listeners would know this, but it was truly a time of campus uproar, anti-war protests, pro-war protests. And we had teach-ins, something called teach-ins. We actually studied
them.
The war.
Yes. I remember them.
And the Pentagon Papers just blew it out of the water. It was a time when there was, you could still make, this side said this side said that. And the Pentagon Papers destroyed that because it laid bare all of the lies. And so I was in Asian studies, and then soon thereafter, I went to cover the war in Cambodia. And by the way, it was for the Washington Post, not the New York Times.
Sorry.
That's okay. I like both papers. I work for both of them.
Well, we like to be correct here, but yes, no, go ahead.
But it prepared me, as this was the first thing. I was a freelancer, then got a contract. It prepared me to really question official, particularly at the U.S. Embassy, because they were in charge of the government's payroll. They oversaw the American air campaign that I covered, and it made me gave all of us the backbone to say, excuse me, this is what we see on the ground, and what you're saying doesn't matter. So it was very important, both in all kinds of ways, and I think I'm representative.
Well, indeed, you are, and you wrote actually in the New York Times that it prepared you for the official lies that you encountered. As you mentioned, you were covering Cambodia. There was a American bombing campaign, and you wrote about, talking to farmers and locals about what they saw and then trying to get a response from the U.S., I guess it was embassy, and finding
yes.
that it was the embassy that was lying about this bombing campaign.
Right. And a colleague of mine, Silvana Foa, was working for UPI. We were the only two women covering the war then in the Cambodia campaign. Mm-hmm. And she wrote a very truthful investigation of how the U.S. Embassy was helping the pilots target different areas of Cambodia, American pilots. And that was totally against the law. And the embassy got her thrown out of the country for making that kind of coverage. So this, even though the papers were published, in 71, the practice of lying didn't end.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to play actually a clip from the Nixon tapes. This is, seems like the day after the publication in the Times. We hear mm-hmm. Alexander Haig, he's White House Chief of Staff, and he's telling President Nixon about the publication. You're going to hear some surprise in Nixon's voice, and then we're going to hear Attorney General John Mitchell at the very end. It's about a minute. Let's give it a listen.
Else of interest in the world?
Yes, sir, very significant, this goddamn New York Times expose of the most highly classified documents of the war.
Oh, that, I see. That I didn't read the story, but you mean that was leaked out of the Pentagon?
Sir, the whole study that was done for McNamara and then carried on after McNamara left by Clifford and the peaceniks over there. This is a devastating security breach of the greatest magnitude of anything I've seen.
Well, what's being done about it then? I mean, I didn't... did we know this was coming out?
No, we did not, sir.
What is your advice on that Times thing, John? You would like to do it?
I would believe so, Mr. President. Otherwise, we will look a little foolish in not following through on our legal obligations. And
has this ever been done before?
Publication like this, or
no. Has the government ever done this to a paper before?
Oh yes, advising of their.
Oh
yes, we've done this before.
Have we? All right.
Yes, sir.
There's so much going on there, Elizabeth
yes.
Becker, in that short exchange between those three very powerful men. What's your takeaway?
That General Haig understood it better than the other two by a long shot. That John Mitchell was wrong, that there had not been a previous prior restraint order placed, and that Richard Nixon is so political that he can't see the forest for the trees, and it's surprising. Later in that day, he had a conversation with Henry Kissinger, who talked to him in political terms. Kissinger at first said, "Oh, this mostly hurts the Democrats, so don't worry about it." I mean, it's a grab bag of just all of the cross currents, and General Haig understood exactly what it was.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the Pentagon Papers. You wrote about this in your piece in the Times. This was a secret history of the Vietnam War based on classified documents commissioned by Defense Secretary Robert McNamara. This was back in 1967. So it starts with Truman and it goes through Lyndon Johnson. It doesn't even cover Richard Nixon. And it's, how damning, I guess in hindsight, really, how damning was it?
Oh, not even just in hindsight. From the very beginning, it was damning. It truly helps understand the beginning of what we now have of public not trusting the government.
Right.
The people in the know said, "Oh, well, everybody should have understood this." No, everybody shouldn't have understood this, because back then in 71, you still had respect for official statements. And this showed from the very beginning that for Cold War ideological reasons, the United States took it upon itself, particularly during the Eisenhower administration, but beginning with Truman's support of France taking back its colonies, the United States took it upon itself to continue that war, despite warnings from their own people on the ground that their idea of what the war meant was wrong. And I guess that's what I would zero in first of all, that this was an ideological war from taking the Cold War, the U.S. versus the Soviet Union, U.S. versus communism, right after World War II, where the presumption was that the Soviet Union wanted to take over the world. And wherever a communist leader showed up, that communist leader had to be in cahoots with the Soviet Union. That wasn't the case with Ho Chi Minh, who was leading the Nationalist War of Independence in Vietnam. But Washington could not be persuaded otherwise. And so you have that ideological drive that pushes out all intelligence and all information. And it sort of forecasts as well the mindset we got into in 2003, when we went to war with Iraq on faulty information, because the ideological bent was this was in retaliation for 9/11, even though that, in fact, what Saddam Hussein was not behind 9/11. So it's both at the time and in hindsight, we can see the importance.
Sure, absolutely. And the lessons and the legacy do continue. You wrote about Robert McNamara. It was he who wanted this investigation into the U.S. Involvement in Vietnam. What was he looking to understand? And you write he was either quixotic or arrogant. I mean, it's a curious document, I guess, coming from he was then, this was the 1960s, the Secretary of Defense.
Well, first of all, he was he was brilliant. He was an intellectual. He was an egghead. President Kennedy brought him on because he was a young man who was, you know, very, very effective in the automobile industry, and he thought he would be very good for the Pentagon. So he comes with automatically already very smart, very arrogant, but and he plunges ahead with the war. And by 1967, he realizes nothing's going to work. More of bombing and more American soldiers aren't going to work. So he commissions this, and I said it was either quixotic or arrogant because. Yeah. He's implied in all of the mistakes, and he's implied in all of the lies. You know, I quote him, the whole section quotes every single, many instances when he's lying. So quixotic in the sense of Don Quixote going after windmills, but brilliant, but arrogant in the sense that if he just gets all of those materials in front of him, and this is a rare document, it's not ideas or anything. This is simply decision-making documents, and that's why it's so potent. He thinks that putting them together, he'll find that one time or those several times when the wrong turn was taken, which is quixotic because, please, it was a series of constant wrong, you know, it was a foundation of lies.
And how secret were these secrets in this document? I mean, and you know, how did the government view the intelligence information in here? Was it, you know, was it the kind of stuff that should have been classified, for instance?
Well, this is before this hyper classification that we suffer from now. These are highly classified, and it showed what was known and what was lied about, that's for certain. But it was highly classified, and they Secretary McNamara gave his secret research team access to everything. He did not, nothing was held back. So this is very, so it is rare, and it was highly classified documents, and it did frighten people that this kind of leak could happen.
That this kind of leak could happen. And of course, the public response was perhaps and we're almost up in a break here, but telling a lot of people what they already knew, that the war was going very badly and we were being lied to.
And remember, by this time, 1971, it was a rare community that didn't know someone who had died in the war. The draft was still on. And that's what makes this a particularly important time. We haven't had a draft war since. So we had Americans from all parts of the country, young men who had to go to war, 500,000 in theater, and they literally were couldn't stand any more young Americans in body bags.
That is Elizabeth Becker, and she covered Cambodia during the 1970s, during the Vietnam War. We're talking about the Pentagon Papers, published the first time 50 years ago this week. We have much more to talk about, including some clips with Daniel Ellsberg. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Elizabeth Becker. She was a correspondent covering Cambodia back in the 1970s, writing for the Washington Post. This was during the Vietnam War. She's the author of a new book called You Do Not Belong Here, about women journalists who covered the Vietnam War. I should also add she was a senior foreign editor for NPR back in the 1990s. I do want to play a clip from a documentary, a 2010 documentary, called Most Dangerous Man, about Daniel Ellsberg. And here he is recalling a conversation he had with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara about the war's prospects, and then is shocked when he hears what McNamara tells reporters. It's about a minute and a half.
On the way back, which was on McNamara's plane, I'd had the chance to give him more than 100 single-space pages of my memos. He sat there, and he hadn't apparently brought a lot to read. And I had the great bureaucratic pleasure of watching my superior actually read my papers and not just toss them aside. So he knew what I was thinking very much about the stalemate in in Vietnam and the fact that things weren't improving. Toward the end of the flight, he called me to the rear of the plane. "Dan, I'm having an argument here. He says that things are improving, that we're making progress, and I say things are worse than they were a year ago. You're the one who knows. What do you say the answer is?" I said, "Well, Mr. Secretary, I'm most impressed with how much the same things are than a year ago." And he said, see, that's exactly what I'm saying. We've put another 100,000 troops in there. Things are no better. That means they're really worse." We were on the ground, and McNamara was going out into a foggy day, and I was behind him.
"You ask whether I was optimistic or pessimistic. Today I can tell you that military progress in the past 12 months has exceeded our expectations."
He was saying, "Gentlemen, I'm very encouraged by what I've seen in Vietnam. In every respect, things are better now. We're making progress. Everything is better." And I was thinking, I hope I'm never in a job where I have to lie like that.
Elizabeth Becker, it's so chilling to hear that. I mean, it's mm-hmm. dramatic and compelling, but also so chilling. The lies,
yes.
and the lies that cost so many lives on both sides of this war.
Yes. And what was remarkable, and I put this in my piece in the New York Times, it was so rare that the awful price that Vietnamese paid was ever mentioned. And it was only when Robert McNamara sent his last big memo in May 1967 to President Johnson that he acknowledged the suffering of the Vietnamese people. And that's why I've reread them for my latest book, The Biography of Three Women War Correspondents in Vietnam. I reread them, and each time, chilling, your word is exactly it, because the bureaucratic language is, it's like a cold knife. When you have been there, you've covered it, and you know what those people suffered, be it the Cambodians I covered, the Vietnamese, the Lao, not to mention the soldiers on all the sides. And it's horrifying.
Let me just make sure our listeners can join our conversation. We are talking about the Pentagon Papers 50 years after the first publication of the papers. And you can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. We've had Daniel Ellsberg on this show, as many people have. He's someone who's written books and made the rounds. And I do remember so clearly him saying, in really a very emotional way, Elizabeth Becker, how he wished he had released the papers or leaked the papers or contacted the Times or the Post sooner so that he could have intervened sooner in trying to stop the war. He got very emotional about that, and it's always stayed uh-huh. it's always stayed with me.
Right. And you have to give Neil Sheehan, the New York Times reporter, credit as well, because he really shepherded, when Daniel Ellsberg came to him, he shepherded him through that decision. And then when Ellsberg was a little hesitant, he went behind Ellsberg's back and Xeroxed the papers. And then Sheehan made sure that the Times understood the importance. And importantly, Sheehan had covered the war in the early days. And for him, it was just as important emotionally. So I don't think it's any accident that the people who were involved in this had felt the cost, the heavy humanitarian and might as well say an environmental cost of that war.
Let me play one more clip, and this is actually former Defense Secretary Robert McNamara. This is 1995. He's on C-SPAN's Book Notes, and here he is talking about the war and the role of the press. Let's give that a listen as well.
Number one, this was the first war, and people don't understand this to this day, the first war in which the press acted without censorship. And I think that was good. The second point is that many people today, and I've heard it expressed within the last week or so, believe that, well, it was the press that lost the war. That they just kept their mouths shut, the people wouldn't have turned away from it, and we'd have had the American people behind it, and we could have won. That is totally wrong. We were fighting, and we didn't realize it, a civil war. Now, true, there were some, obviously, there was Soviet and Chinese influence and support, and no question the communists were trying to control South Vietnam, but it was basically a civil war. And one of the things we should learn is you can't fight and win a civil war with outside troops, and particularly not when the political structure in a country is dissolved. So it wasn't the press that was the problem. It was the problem was that we were in the wrong place with the wrong tactics.
Back to you, Elizabeth Becker. Again, there's a lot going on in that. Let's talk about the press part. The press, I mean, you and I are probably around the same age. I mean, I remember that time so well and how the press was blamed because of all the coverage that was coming into our living rooms. And you could see firsthand what was going on in this war. And the press was blamed by a lot of people, including Richard Nixon, of course, for fomenting criticism of the war, but also its coverage of the war.
Okay, just a couple of points here. The reason why the press was so open was because President Johnson did not want to declare war. So he left the usual restrictions on press. They were moot. They were not applied, which is, in fact, why the press, if you had a card, a credential, you could get a commander to say, can I come with you on this battle? And they say, okay, and you jumped on the helicopter. And when another helicopter came and you wanted to leave, you could. I mean, you were not embedded. You did not have to stay with the unit. You could come and go. And I have to say, just as an aside, that's the reason why women were able to break through for the very first time and forever, because there was the restriction against women covering a war in the battlefield, which had held strongly before that. It was no longer, it was moot. So that's the reason why Vietnam was also the first war that women covered from the battlefield and would cover. And from then on, that restriction was gone. So I'll just throw that in.
Sure, no, that's important.
And it was, as one wonderful Jonathan Schell said, it was like having a Eurorail pass. You could go anywhere, you could cover, you could spend as long as you want. And you had some of the most original war reporting. I highlighted the three pioneer women in my book who did that original reporting, and there were others. And it was really important. And I think that goes to the question, why did the officials then say they didn't understand the war? Well, if Francis Fitzgerald in 1966 could write in the New York Times magazine what was the problem and why the South Vietnamese were not going to win, why did U.S. officials have such willful ignorance? So it was very good, but he's right. I mean, to this day, the press is blamed for the loss of the war in Vietnam. In fact, it's very hard for still many people in the Pentagon to admit that the United States lost that war.
Well, and as you mentioned, the Iraq War, which was based on all sorts of false allegations about weapons of mass destruction. I mean, it seems we didn't learn some of the lessons of the Pentagon Papers and even what Robert McNamara was talking about getting involved in internal conflicts.
Well, yes, and that's where you get the lessons learned issue. Who's writing the lessons and who's teaching them? And I think that's the true value of the Pentagon Papers. This is them talking. This is not a historian. This is not talking heads like you and I.
Sure.
These are the actual documents. And that's why all of us who write about the war, you go back to the Pentagon Papers. It is the Rosetta Stone. You read them, and you don't have to read all of them because the various tomes are good, capturing bits and pieces. You hear them. You see what they knew and why they wanted to cover it up. Because, and this is the one lesson that this should have been learned. It's so easy to get into war, and it's so hard to get out of a war.
Yeah. I mean, we saw that certainly in Iraq, and we're seeing that in Afghanistan.
Afghanistan.
Absolutely. Elizabeth Becker is our guest. We are talking about the Pentagon Papers. They were published, the first of a series of papers were published 50 years ago this week. And again, you can join our conversation, Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can always call us at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Greg to join us, and Greg is calling us from Chester County, which is just outside of Philadelphia. And Greg, Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was drafted in 1970 after I graduated college and was married. It was meant for punishment. It ruined my life. I'm still suffering from chronic PTSD, and I could not get my benefits. And the whole war resistance was repressed through the COINTELPRO program by J. Edgar Hoover and Nixon. So we don't even have a clear history from the people who served, and nobody asks us, and nobody cares at this point. I don't know what happened to all the people who protested that war, but they're not on my side at this point.
Well, Greg, first of all, people do care. I want you to know that. That's important, and we are, you know, sorry to hear you're still suffering from the effects of that war, but you're not alone. I want you to know that.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Anything else you want to say, Greg?
Yes. I have worked at the VA, and the people from Iraq and Afghanistan are suffering the same fates, even though there's more attention to them. The suicides are 20 a day. It's horrendous how we treat our veterans, and we have to start being patriotic to the people who serve for our Constitution, for everybody. I sacrificed all my rights for everybody else's, and I would like them back.
Well,
Speaking to this issue has given me some empowerment.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad, and I really appreciate you calling into Radio Times, Greg. And let me give Elizabeth.
Thank you for the time.
You're welcome. Let me give Elizabeth Becker a chance to respond. I mean, you know, these are heartfelt calls.
Yes, and thank you for calling in, Greg. In my last book, I in fact make sure that people understand how the Vietnam veterans were not treated well. The establishment, the American Foreign Legion, and the others considered them hippie losers. When the Vietnam veterans had to raise money for their own memorial, the very famous Vietnam Memorial down in Armal, I'm in Washington, and then even when the inauguration, President Reagan refused to attend. Only the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Vesey, John Vesey, came. So it's the hypocrisy of thank you for your service, but oh, we're not paying attention to how you really are treated. And it's no accident that after Vietnam, the draft ended.
Absolutely, Greg. Again, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Here's a question from James Elizabeth, who says, did the Pentagon Papers make clear that the Gulf of Tonkin was a lie? Also wanted to add that the Vietnam War, first time countries suffered major divisions, both socially and politically. You wrote about the Gulf of Tonkin, as other people have as well. Is that part of the Pentagon Papers?
Well, what's part of the Pentagon Papers is how that General Westmoreland, and who was the head of the American military mission in Vietnam, orchestrated it to create a pretext for war. It does not say 100% it never happened. That came later with investigative reporting, I believe, in the 1990s. Hmm. But there's no question in the Pentagon Papers that it was orchestrated, and it's very fuzzy about whether it happened, but it doesn't say no, it never happened. And yes, he's totally right. The division socially and politically and culturally was the deepest since the Civil War in the United States because of Vietnam. Mm. Very much so.
Michael has a comment here. The American motivation to go to Vietnam was really about propping up the French in 1954. The Pentagon Papers, you know, goes back that far, Elizabeth.
Right. And that's why I said that the original sin was to support the French to keep the colony after World War II. And because the United States believed in the domino theory that if Vietnam became communist, then the rest of Southeast Asia would, the United States turned around and then refused to accept the Geneva Peace Accords that France signed and Great Britain and the European allies signed that would have ended the war. And that's the tragedy. Mm. It could have been over in 55. But Truman supported the French taking back the colony. And then when the French said, okay, we lost at Dien Bien Phu, let's have peace, end of war, the United States said, no, we're going to continue.
We only have a couple more minutes. I mean, do you think we have learned any lessons from the Pentagon Papers?
Well, as a country, it's hard to say what we learned from anything. But I think the Pentagon Papers continue to teach us, and that's why I was so pleased to write in the New York Times section this weekend. It continues to teach us. It continues to show us how political figures could get enmeshed in these kinds of lies, what we should look out for, why we should not be afraid to challenge those kinds of lessons. And just when you're the hubris and arrogance of great power is, since classic times, that is the vulnerability.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that hubris today? So I had to ask. Go ahead, Elizabeth Becker.
Why can't we just be a really wonderful country? Why do we have to be number one?
Well, interesting. I mean, we are. I guess we still are the world's lone superpower. I guess it's kind of lonely, correct?
The question is how we use our power, and I think that's what we are dealing with right now today. After the drastic difference between the Trump administration and now President Biden, we see that whether there's another superpower on the rise, i.e. China, or not, the question for us is how we use our power, and it's getting down to, how is it working for everyone in the United States? And this is also part of being a superpower, and we're clearly feel that we're on the wane.
Well, Elizabeth Becker, it's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate your writing and you joining us today in Radio Times as well.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Again, Elizabeth Becker was a correspondent covering Cambodia back in the 1970s during the Vietnam War. And her new book is called You Do Not Belong Here. You Do Not Belong Here, about women journalists who covered the Vietnam War. Well, from the Pentagon Papers to the Trump administration pressuring the Justice Department to get records on lawmakers and reporters and reverse the 2020 election. That's coming up right after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoene, and you're listening to
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. We're learning more about the pressure the Trump White House put on the Justice Department in the waning days of Trump's presidency to promote false claims of voter fraud and reverse the results of the 2020 election. New emails released this week show the extent of the pressure campaign and the response from Acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen and members of the department, one remarking, pure insanity. We also learned recently that President Trump's DOJ secretly surveilled Democratic lawmakers and journalists in an investigation into alleged leaks. Current Attorney General Merrick Garland has promised reforms. As we mark the 50th anniversary of the publication of the Pentagon Papers, where do things stand today when it comes to press freedom, the rule of law, and the abuse of power? Craig Green joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's a professor of law at Temple University, former Justice Department lawyer under the Bush administration. He also clerked for Merrick Garland. And Craig Green, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, we want to make sure you can join our conversation. We've got a lot to cover. Radio Times at WHYY.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Just a quick response, if you don't mind, to the legacy of the publication of the Pentagon Papers. This was the U.S. Supreme Court signed 6-3, a decision basically that the government cannot interfere to stop the publication of material that could be damning or embarrassing. This is prior restraint. What do you make of what the Supreme Court did 50 years ago, and does it hold today?
Oh, yeah. I think it's incredibly important. It shapes everything the way the government thinks of how it goes about its business and the press. There's a quote from a district court opinion in one of the Pentagon Papers cases that I really thought of for today's segment. National security is not at the ramparts alone. It also lies in the value of free institutions. And I think those questions about free institutions, whether you're talking about the press or you're talking about the Department of Justice or you're talking about Congress's independent branch or the Supreme Court, I think those free institutions are collateral aspects of thinking about things we take for granted in a functioning government. And I think those things have been challenged in new ways in recent years. And I think that's part of what has come to light in the last couple weeks.
I mean, successive administrations have done all sorts of things to protect themselves from investigation, including the Obama administration went after journalists and whistleblowers. So while the Supreme Court made that decision 50 years ago, there certainly have been administrations who have lied to the public, who have done things that they tried to cover up, have gone after journalists and others.
For sure. And we haven't even said Watergate yet, I don't think.
We have not, but we should.
But this point you made about the Obama administration is an illustrative difference. So the Obama administration brought more Espionage Act convictions for these sort of leaks than all of the presidents before him. But the difference was that Obama was concerned about perceiving political influence. And so he took a lot of steps to insulate himself personally from those investigations of leaks. Former President Trump did the opposite of that. He had his attorney general, and he went on Twitter, and he made very clear that he himself and his administration wanted to punish leakers. And I think that really casts a different light when you look on some of the events we're going to talk about in today's segment.
Well, and it also, I think, highlights former President Trump's view of the Department of Justice. I mean, he made it clear in so many different ways that he saw the attorney general and people who work for the attorney general as part of his legal team.
That's right. The Department of Justice has a very split role over time. And the best traditions of the Department of Justice have viewed it as the people's lawyers and representing the government, and in many aspects has served as a break against some aspects of presidential abuse. But of course, it wasn't just the DOJ that former President Trump expressed contempt for, also the courts, also Congress, especially the press. And so you had a real combination of attacks on free institutions that I think a lot of different entities and a lot of the public are sort of struggling or stumbling to figure out how to think about in the aftermath. How credible is the Department of Justice today, not 3 months ago?
How do we compare, let's say, Nixon and Trump? How do you see their parallels or dissimilarities?
I think even then, the institutions in the Nixon administration, the reaction of the Republican Party was so different from what I think one sees today. And you have a lot of explanations for why Trump's attacks on some of these institutions feel different, from variegated press streams to social media to various kinds of political polarization that ultimately at least can be tracked back to Bush v. Gore in 2000. It's not as though the country split around Donald Trump. It's been split for a long time. And so I think there are various aspects of that where, you know, the Nixon era, you could still have a really broad outrage for the Pentagon Papers. You get a really broad outrage for Watergate. You could have a president resign rather than face impeachment. And of course, in recent years, we don't have any of those as benchmarks for today.
Well, in fact, we can't even investigate, or Congress can't even investigate, the attack on Congress of January 6th.
That's right. Congressional investigations, of course, the Mueller special counsel, investigative journalism, which has been some of the stuff that's come up in the last couple of weeks. All of these different ways of holding a president accountable, formerly, in some respects, taken for granted, or at least thought to be lessons learned from the 1970s. I think those lessons, in some sense, have been challenged. And I think the future will tell whether they've been relearned or unlearned.
Well, let me ask you about how you then see how the Justice Department, this was for about a month's time, the very end of the Trump administration. So we're talking about December and then sort of a little bit into January, putting pressure on the DOJ to try to overturn the results of the election. Did the system hold?
Yeah, I think actually the immediate question of pushing the election fraud arguments, I think actually might feel like a little bit of a success story for the department. There were elements of the Department of Justice, I think particularly there are rumors of sort of Jeffrey Clark, an attorney general for the Civil Division, that maybe he could have come into power and really turned the Department of Justice into a private law firm for Trump. But actually, Jeffrey Rosen, I think, consistently
was
resisted.
Acting AG.
Correct. And his deputy also. And of course, by that time, Jeffrey Rosen is only there because, if I could put it this way, even Bill Barr resigned in the face of having to push forward some of these. The imputation, that's what people think. Obviously, there might be congressional testimony from, for example, Sessions, Rosenstein, Barr, Rosen, all the people who have served in that position. But I think there was a real struggle throughout the years. But this last episode where I think, as you mentioned, from the minute Barr is stepping down, Jeffrey Rosen is being barraged by efforts to have the U.S. Department of Justice step up and stand for the president. And you have to remember, of course, not the first time there's been controversial litigation about,
sure.
You know, but, you know, that's not, you know, the Clinton White House didn't have the DOJ support Al Gore in Bush v. Gore, and it would have been outrageous to think that Obama's Justice Department could have tried to stand in or do anything with respect to Trump's election in 2016. So this use of this final abuse of the DOJ, they did successfully resist. And I think there's something to be proud of there.
Let me play a clip. It's been played a lot, but this is then-Senator Kamala Harris. She's obviously now our vice president. She's questioning Attorney General William Barr. This is May 1st, 2019, so 2 years ago, during the Russia investigation about whether President Trump or anyone else in the White House had asked Barr to investigate anyone. I should add that this exchange is getting some new scrutiny with the revelation that the Trump DOJ surveilled lawmakers and reporters during a leak investigation. Let's give it a, it's about a minute. Let's give it a listen.
Attorney General Barr, has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone?
I wouldn't.
Yes or no?
Could you repeat that question?
I will repeat it. Yeah. Has the president or anyone at the White House ever asked or suggested that you open an investigation of anyone? Yes or no, please, sir.
The president or anybody else.
Seems you would remember something like that and be able to tell us.
Yeah, but I'm trying to grapple with the word suggest. I mean, there have been discussions of matters out there that they have not asked me to open an investigation. But
perhaps they've suggested.
I don't know. I wouldn't say suggest.
Hinted?
I don't know.
Inferred? You don't know. Okay.
I mean, how many times have we heard that? But now with these new revelations about investigating lawmakers and all that, it has some new credence. And Craig, you and I were sort of chatting as we were listening. What did she know? What did Kamala Harris know?
It's almost like that. But I think it's so uncanny. And especially when you put together the last recent weeks, you have, as you mentioned, the election pressure on the DOJ. You had surveillance of Don McGahn, who was White House counsel during his time. You had four New York Times reporters, a CNN commentator, three Washington Post reporters, and Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell in Congress. And all of these people are being investigated. They were all very closely connected to alleged leaks about the Trump administration. There's almost no way to believe in hindsight that Attorney General Barr hadn't had some suggestion or inference or hints, any of those sort of words that then Senator Harris used. There's almost no way to believe because Attorney General Barr and the Department of Justice were in fact pursuing investigations that seem so closely linked to nothing other than Donald Trump's personal interest. One other last detail is the election result pressure. The lawyers who were participating in that said, "I am specifically here on behalf of the President Donald mm-hmm. Trump." So this idea of Trump's personal involvement, I think there are fingerprints from top to bottom, and it does. It's almost like she was looking at a crystal ball. I think that's the way it looks.
And he's dancing around. I mean, you can't lie to Congress, right? I mean, allegedly pay a price for that.
That's right. A blunt talking and very sophisticated lawyer, Bill Barr, caught really sort of almost red-handed and can do nothing else. If you see the video, he has sort of moments where he tries not to say anything and just sort of looks off in the distance. And I think one of the things that's in the future for us is the possibility of congressional testimony from, among other folks, McGahn, these sort of attorneys general and Barr. And I think it will be very awkward and difficult for those people. Of course it's true. Lying to Congress is no good. And I think that could in turn create all kinds of professional and ultimately even possibly criminal responsibility.
Paul asks, why are there no consequences for any of these people from the damage they've done? McNamara lying and getting so many people killed in the war to the damage that Trump has done.
Yeah, I think I think that's really, in the end, it's such a complicated and hard question. My best answer in the shortest form is I think it's up to the American people. I think the American people in some ways have held Nixon responsible. I think he was very, very popular. He got reelected.
He did. And I think overwhelmingly.
And he's not, and that was after Watergate. It was already unfolding. And he doesn't have that status today. And I think that the question of what Trump's legacy will be is not up to Congress, and it's not up to the legal system, and it's not even up to the Supreme Court, it's up to the American people. And the American people will look at the threats, which I think they have to be called, to free institutions in the service of what seem to be personal presidential politics. And I think they have to make their judgments for themselves and what to expect from a Biden purporting to reinvigorate some of these institutional norms, and, of course, Attorney General Garland as well.
Let me quote from Barbara Starr. She's the CNN reporter that was investigated. She had a piece on CNN just a day or so ago. She says, speaking for myself, I don't know what the government was looking for when it snuck into my life. I'm not the subject of an investigation. There's no suggestion of wrongdoing. But as a CNN journalist, myself and my newsroom clearly were being used as a tool by the Trump Justice Department. Then she goes on to say, unless new protections are codified, this could all happen again to any journalist. Secret proceedings, gag orders, so CNN attorneys can't speak to me, and eight reporters being swept up in investigations with no explanation. These are not part of a free press in the United States.
And you might have, for these sort of statutory reforms, you might have a really good intersection between threats to the press, which are not entirely new, but were newly pursued with gag orders, as this investigation began at CNN, New York Times, Washington Post. All those folks were required to be quiet about it for months and months, which I think is quite distressing. Barbara Starr only learned about it quite late in the process. But also this investigation of members of Congress, 73 phone numbers, 36 email accounts, and again, three non-disclosure orders. And I think when you start to mess with Congress and the idea that the president and the FBI and the DOJ might be investigating members of Congress, I tell you, nothing gets more bipartisan support and hackles up than the possibility, although Senator McConnell may be going a different direction. But I think this idea of a threat to the press and a threat to Congress at the same time might actually get legislation done, which is a hard thing to imagine in the current political climate anyway.
Merrick Garland, the current attorney general, spoke to this. Did he address, you think, the concerns that, that many people have?
Well, I think several things have happened. One, I think he does have new he's contemplating his promised new regulations concerning the investigation of the press. President Biden spoke about that very directly, saying this is a terrible behavior and won't be done in my administration. I think also the other thing to say about Merrick Garland, if I could, is, you know, he's spent his whole life from working in the Department of Justice before to being a judge to now on behalf of institutional norms. He's a person who, for better or worse, he really believes in institutions and in the rule of law over politics, and whether he can earn, which is what he'd have to do, earn the public trust that this is a restoration of better traditions of the Department of Justice as opposed to worser. You know, that's what I mean. This is not the first time the Department of Justice has been threatened, but I think there is a new challenge for him, and I think in some sense he might be the person for the moment.
But what does he have to say? What does he have to do? He has been speaking. Is he saying the right things? Is he saying it in the way that speaks to this moment that we're in?
I think about the press, I think for sure he does. So I think he in the same way, actually, Attorney General Holder under the Obama administration came out with new regulations when there were challenges to how they had surveilled 20 AP reporters. I think he has in mind to tighten the restrictions, make it harder for the government to surveil the press in this way, which I think is very important. With respect to Congress, I think he has referred several matters to the Inspector General. This is the same Inspector General who did sort of investigations of the Russia investigation and so forth. And I think that, again, is at least for some people who believe that is a purportedly, ostensibly, aspirationally neutral institution that will produce a public report that will sort of notch the pros and cons and the mistakes that were made. And I think that for people who believe that kind of information, for people willing to believe that kind of information, it can provide a way to trust the government going forward and think that we're being run under government by the people.
The operative word being if people will believe this, right? And which we could talk about and probably should talk about during another show. Craig Green, thank you as always for joining us today on Radio
Thank
Times.
You so much. I love the show.
We appreciate that. He's a professor of law at Temple University, former Department of Justice lawyer, and he did clerk for Merrick Garland. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. You can do that wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, Kelsey Hansen, and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.